We are talking with author Eric Schlosser, who is best known for his last book, Fast Food Nation. He's in town with his new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. Eric, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So how is it that you chose to write your current book, the subject matter that you're focusing on?
Well, I had spent time in the late 90s looking at various aspects of the underground economy for the Atlantic Monthly, and I just became really interested in this whole other economy. At a time when we're hearing all this free market rhetoric in the United States, here were some markets that seemed to be obeying the same economic laws, but weren't so free. And so, I started reading a lot about underground economies and the economics of them. And work that I've been doing for The Atlantic really fit into that whole notion. And so that's where this book came from. It's actually a book that I'd wanted to do before Fast Food Nation, but I was already successful as a journalist, but no publishers were eager to publish it. So I did Fast Food Nation first, and I'm glad, actually, that came out first and not this one, because somehow there's a logic to this. This is in a way a bridge to the next book I'm doing, which is on prisons. And if you look at the prisons, a lot of the people in prison come out of the underground economy that I'm writing about in this book. So anyway, that's the story behind it.
All right, and it deals a lot with what a lot of people call the black market. Can you tell us what is the black market?
Yeah, the black market is all the economic activity in a country that's off the books, that's unreported, unrecorded, or somehow in violation of the law. And that's a very broad category. It could include something innocuous, like paying your house painter in cash, you know, aware that this isn't going to be reported to the IRS, to less innocuous, cooking methamphetamine in your kitchen and, you know, running a drug ring from your house. So it involves criminal activity, tax evasion, all off-the-books activity. And it became interesting to me because of how much of it there is. And economists have a hard time putting an exact number on how big the black market is because people are deliberately hiding these things. But at the same time, there's a consensus that the black market has been growing, hugely growing in the United States over the last 25 years. So I thought it was interesting to look at this phenomenon because it tells you a lot about the mainstream, and it tells you a lot about this country.
Would it be fair to say that the black market is something that your average American participates in?
You know, just about everyone does, to varying extents. And even if you don't smoke pot or hire a babysitter and pay her in cash or, you know, practice tax evasion, if you pay your taxes, you're being affected by this underground economy, because there are millions and millions of people who aren't paying taxes. And when you pay taxes, you're paying for the rest of them. You're paying for their government services. So it's a very important subject. And ideally, the black market would be as small as possible in a country. And as the black market's getting bigger and bigger, it's a symptom that something's wrong, or that things are wrong, and that the laws don't really reflect what people want, or that there is a disrespect for society and people feel the government isn't something they support and they don't want to pay for. So ideally, the black market wouldn't be too big. And in the United States at the moment, it's absolutely gigantic.
Did you get a sense in your research what was the big contributors to its growth in the last 25 years as compared to the previous 175?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are different parts of the underground economy. I write about marijuana, which is the most widely used illegal drug. And it's a huge, huge, multi-billion dollar American industry. Now, it's gotten bigger, not necessarily because more people are smoking pot. People were smoking more pot probably in the 70s than today. But it's gotten bigger because the laws against marijuana have gotten so tough. It's a strange relationship. The tougher the laws are against something, the more valuable a commodity it is. So that's one explanation for the rise in the marijuana black market. In terms of illegal immigrants, which is another part of my book, illegal immigrants are black market labor, cheap labor, off-the-books labor. And to the degree that the government turns a blind eye to this sort of activity, to the degree that that businesses are allowed to import illegals deliberately to break unions and cut wages, and to the degree that we allow this sort of exploitation to continue, the black market, labor black market, gets bigger. So there are all sorts of explanations. People on the right would argue that when taxes get too high, the black market grows because ordinary citizens start avoiding taxes and doing all kinds of things for cash. And people on the left would argue that when economic times get hard, people turn to the black market. And when the government doesn't pay attention to what business is doing, businesses turn to the black market. So there's not any one cause. There are different causes for different aspects of the underground. But the fact that it's getting bigger is disturbing.
So the three areas that you focus on, are those the three biggest money-making areas on the black market?
You know, there are three important parts of the black market, but there's a reason why I looked at each one. Marijuana, as I said, is the nation's most popular illegal drug, so that's a black market commodity. And I look at that industry and how that evolved. Illegal immigrants, and I look at them in California agriculture, are black market labor, which has huge implications for all labor, for all working people in the United States. If you can bring in illegals to do a job, many people's jobs are at risk because illegals will work for less money, often won't complain about dangerous working conditions, and there's a modern form of servitude that is now happening in the United States in agriculture. So that's the black market labor section. And then pornography is interesting to me as a case study in how the black market becomes the mainstream. 30, 40 years ago, pornography was as black market as any other commodity. And it's amazing what you could get sent to prison for, just for saying dirty words in a nightclub act, for publishing pictures of women with their shirts off. People were sent to prison for. And so the government behaves one way towards pornography when it's kind of radicals and fringe figures and organized crime figures producing the material. Today, pornography has gone mainstream. It's corporate. Very, very big corporations are earning tens of millions of dollars from pornography. And the government is not indicting executives at AOL Time Warner, for example, for distributing pornography on their cable systems that would have gotten you sent to prison, easily 30, 35 years ago. And certainly HBO right now has much more sexually explicit material on it than, what you get sent to prison for in the 1950s. So I'm not arguing in favor of pornography or against it, but just trying to see how the black market becomes a mainstream, how the government treats it differently, and who benefits.
So do these things do well on the black market because there's a demand for it and it's not being brought to us via the regular corporate markets?
Yeah. Well, in the book I try to look at the whole notion of the free market and how it's applied and how it's not applied. And Adam Smith's theory of the free market was that the marketplace represented the sum of all human wishes, that it was democracy in action, and that what people wanted to buy would be supplied by, manufacturers or suppliers, and the invisible hand, the hand of the divinity, would make sure that would happen. Now, when you see the black market, it's because there are things that people want to buy that they're not supposed to buy, that the mainstream isn't providing. And ultimately, I argue that that's just as revealing about America, it's just as revealing about our democracy as, Microsoft or Boeing or any of the big companies that are in the mainstream. And that ultimately, these distinctions between the mainstream or underground are important from a legal sense, because selling one thing can get you on the cover of Fortune magazine, and selling another thing can get you life without parole in prison. But if you step back further from that, the distinction between the underground and the mainstream, I think, is artificial. It's one country, one economy, one set of, purchases, and a lot of people are involved in the black market as consumers. It's a lot of pot being smoked, for example.
And would you say that the people that participate and run the black market, would those be more average Americans than people in the legal economy?
Well, it varies. It depends on which part of the black market you're talking about. If you're talking about a plumber who wants to work for cash and is glad to work for cash, we all know those sorts of people. If you're talking about a major crack dealer, methamphetamine manufacturer, that's That's a little bit more on the margin. Marijuana growers, much more mainstream. The marijuana market is not like the cocaine market. It's not controlled by overseas cartels. Most of the marijuana in America is being grown in the heartland, is being grown in the Midwest by people often who have very strong farming skills. They don't see anything wrong with what they're growing. They need the money, and they're ordinary Americans.
Talk a little bit more about marijuana. It used to be, to my understanding, part of this country's history, on the positive sense, where people were expected to grow it?
Yeah. The first American law pertaining to marijuana was passed by the Virginia Assembly in 1619, and it required every household to grow it, because marijuana was known as hemp, and hemp was a very useful fiber for making sails, for making paper, for making cloth. And, you know, a number of states required you to grow marijuana, and a number of states in the early colonial days allowed marijuana to be used as legal tender because there were, you know, concerns about currency, but everyone agreed that this commodity, had real value. It wasn't until the early years of the 20th century that people, to use a phrase, freaked out about marijuana. And it was because there was a wave of Mexican immigration to the United States. Marijuana was the preferred intoxicant of poor Mexicans and Mexican peasants. It also was a drug that, you know, black people, and particularly jazz musicians, like to use. And this drug became associated with minorities that mainstream America feared. And in looking at marijuana, I'm looking at a black market item that I think the laws that we've had in the last 100 years pertaining to marijuana have much more to do with who likes to smoke it than any of the characteristics of the drug. And what you see is the government intervening quite fiercely in the market on moral grounds when it comes to marijuana. And in the farm worker section, the illegal immigrant section, you'll find that people are being brutally exploited. People are being, the farm workers are being terribly mistreated, but the government refuses to intervene because, the free market means you can't intervene on behalf of poor workers, but those same people have no problem intervening on moral grounds to punish pot smokers, often for very trivial amounts of the drug.
Isn't that true to some degree, too, in the pornography industry, where there's definitely a certain class of people that are being exploited here?
There's no question that they're being exploited. I mean, some of the women in the industry are really being mistreated. There was a huge desire to intervene for many, many years on moral grounds, not really on behalf of those women, but on behalf of saving Americans from sinfulness. The obscenity laws that for so many years put people in prison or threatened them with prison for selling sexually explicit material, was based on a Christian notion of blasphemy. And, watching pornography was going to damage, literally, your soul. And that law, those laws are still on the books in many places. Under federal law, the obscenity laws still exist. But what's interesting, again, is that there have been huge pornography crackdowns when it was more fringe elements who were distributing this material. But now that it's really gone mainstream, I would be very surprised to see any AOL Time Warner executives, indicted for what they're selling on their cable systems.
Those are the same people that are cooperating with having their movies screened by people like, well, not directly John Ashcroft, but John Ashcroft's crews for, taking out certain content and stuff.
Yeah.
So
it's amazing.
So the sticking with the drug industry, did you expand on more than just marijuana? My question being, it seems that the government on this would have to know what's going on, and I think you used the term turning a blind eye earlier. We know that in big drug sales that the money used to purchase it goes through the banks. Clearly the banks, and there's been insiders in the banks that said, yeah, we knew that was going on.
Yeah.
So therefore you would assume the government must know what's going on. So how can they, on the one hand, be fighting this drug war, on the other hand, turning a blind eye to all this?
Well, I think that I really wrote about marijuana. I didn't write about cocaine and heroin. I, I, I think marijuana is a separate category, and it's, you know, more people smoke pot than use all other illegal drugs combined. So marijuana is the illegal drug of choice. It's also the drug that we grow here and produce here and distribute here, so you can't blame it on a foreign country. And I also think that of the illegal drugs, it's the one that poses the least harm and should be looked at as a separate category. The government definitely knows that this is a multi-billion dollar industry in America. But I think that its opposition to marijuana is sincere, and it's based on very moralistic and often racist attitudes. Marijuana is the intoxicant that not just minorities, but nonconformists have smoked. I mean, if you look at who has smoked marijuana in the last 100 years, it's poor Mexicans, poor blacks, jazz musicians, beatniks, hippies, damn hippies, people in the hip-hop community. These are people who have threatened the mainstream one way or another. And, I mean, the most dangerous drug being used in America today is probably tobacco. You know, over 400,000 Americans die every year from smoking tobacco. Our government subsidizes tobacco production. And I'm not calling for tobacco to be outlawed, but when you look at 400,000 people dying every year from tobacco, you know, over 100,000 a year die from alcohol. And, you know, there are probably people who have died one way or another after smoking pot, but it's never been proven. There is no case yet that of mortality that has been directly linked to smoking pot. It has one of the lowest toxicities of any, you know, psychotropic drugs ever discovered. There is no proven fatal dose, and scientists have estimated that in order to overdose and die from smoking marijuana, you'd have to smoke 100 pounds a minute for 15 minutes. Now, I'm not encouraging any of your listeners to try that, and I'm not saying it's a totally harmless drug, and there are a lot of reasons not to smoke pot. But when you compare its low toxicity to these other forms of intoxicants that clearly cause enormous, enormous damage, you have to wonder about why the laws are so tough against marijuana. And I think it has to do with moral and racial views.
And with the current administration, is it your impression that things are getting worse with this?
The current administration has vowed to escalate the war on marijuana. The Justice Department sent a letter to prosecutors nationwide, not just federal prosecutors, but all prosecutors, that they want the marijuana laws enforced to the fullest. And just recently, right before we went to war with Iraq, while the nation was on Code Orange, high alert of terrorism, you know, and there were fears of Al-Qaeda under, you know, in every house in America, the Justice Department took time out from searching for terrorists to stage a nationwide roundup of bong manufacturers and roach clip manufacturers supervised by Attorney General John Ashcroft. It had a name. You know, we give our wars names now, and this one was called Operation Pipe Dreams. It involved over 1,000 law enforcement officers nationwide in simultaneous raids on, you know, bong makers and roach clip makers. And I couldn't make this up. It's true. It happened. And among those who were busted was Tommy Chong, half of the Cheech and Chong Comedy Act. But I think someone at the Justice Department has actually smoked pot, because after he was arrested, I think someone realized, oh my God, we can't charge Tommy Chong because that'll just heap a lot of publicity and ridicule on us. But Tommy Chong, you know, has endorsed a line of bongs, and as a public enemy, he got busted. And it's incredible. Some of these people are facing long prison terms for making roach clips and selling bongs. And that's where we are in the year 2003.
Now, are there leaders, elected congressional or Senate reps, that are resisting this?
Not really. There's not a lot of defense for pot smokers in Congress today. It's viewed as something that doesn't have a lot of political support. And if you look at when there was the real push at the national level for decriminalization, it was in the late 60s and early 70s. And the reason was that was the only time in our history when white middle-class kids were getting long prison sentences for marijuana. Most of the people who'd been prosecuted for marijuana crimes up to then had been poor blacks and poor Mexicans and the occasional unlucky beatnik. And marijuana use began to decline precipitously in the late 1970s, long before any of these tough laws were passed. And for the most part today, it's poor people and people of color who are being locked away from marijuana. So I think if there were more white middle-class kids in large numbers getting in prison, there might be more of an outcry, especially in Congress. But I don't expect any of the changes to come from Congress. I think it's going to happen at the local level.
Like cities and counties, or
like cities and counties, and people just making their views known that this, you know, war on pot smokers is absurd. There are more people in prison right now for marijuana than at any other time in our history. There are a lot of people serving life sentences without parole for marijuana, and it's crazy. The rest of the world, the rest of the Western industrialized world, is moving in exactly the opposite direction. Canada has said that it would like to decriminalize, is on the verge of decriminalizing, but is being threatened by the Bush administration. Our drug czar, John Waters, has said that, you know, this would be like allowing Canada to ship poison into this country, and they're going to try to check trucks and slow up exports from Canada as a way of punishing Canada. Meanwhile, marijuana has been decriminalized in Portugal, in Spain, in Italy, in the Netherlands, and those countries have not yet collapsed. As a matter of fact, they smoke less pot than we do. So I think our policies are not going to last. I don't know how much longer, you know, people have to be in prison before things change. But I don't expect the change to start in Washington. It will follow when, you know, people at the local level really make their views known.
Let's talk about cheap labor. Immigrants is always a subject that a lot of politicians like to weave into their rhetoric. Yet here in Washington State, we sell a lot of apples, and those apples primarily are picked by immigrants.
Yeah.
So, I mean, here's something that people that we desperately need that support our economy, and yet when these politicians come before a microphone, they talk about how these people are stealing jobs and ruining the economy. The two don't seem to make sense.
Yeah, they really don't make sense. And I became interested in the whole issue when politicians in California were really scapegoating illegal immigrants. And were saying that illegal immigrants are coming to California to live on welfare, to basically get their children, you know, educated and get free benefits from the state. And that didn't really square with my own experience in California, where the illegals that I'd seen and met were working very hard. And, you know, in looking at California agriculture, I found that the largest sector of the California economy, agriculture is still the biggest industry, had become totally dependent on recent immigrants and on illegal immigrants. Far from being welfare cheats, these are people who are propping up the state's economy. And what was really unbelievable is that a lot of the politicians who were using the scapegoating of illegals to gain power, you know, were getting enormous contributions from the industries that benefited from these illegals. So, you know, it's a very, I've tried very hard, even though I have problems with the role of illegals in our economy and what it means for the future. And I think that, you know, as the black market for labor increases, it's a bad thing. I'm very adamant about how these illegals themselves shouldn't be scapegoated or shouldn't face discrimination. It's the very powerful interests that are exploiting them who I think deserve, you know, the anger. But it's politically, it's been very effective to put all the blame on the illegals and focus attention on the illegals and not focus attention on the industries that are, you know, earning a fortune by exploiting them.
You said at the beginning of when we started talking that this had your current book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market, that this had been the first book that you had wanted to pursue, but it just worked out to be the second one. When you finally started getting into working on this book and writing it, did you end up discovering things that you hadn't expected to find?
Well, you know, I really didn't know anything about these subjects. I mean, I've smoked pot. I've eaten strawberries. I read about the strawberry industry. I've watched some porn. But I had no idea what the worlds behind these commodities were. And, you know, this is a book similar to Fast Food Nation, and this is another business book. It's just looking at businesses that you don't really hear about. And I'm trying to look beyond the commodity and show where it comes from and how it's made and the systems behind it. So, you know, an editor at the Atlantic Monthly called me one day and asked me, "Eric, you know if there's anyone in prison today for marijuana?" And I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "Well, why don't you go find out?" And in looking at that question and realizing that there were people getting life sentences without parole for relatively trivial marijuana crimes, it just blew my mind. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And that led me into looking at the history of marijuana, you know, the properties of the drug. And one of the scariest things in looking at the war on drugs is the rise of state power, and particularly the rise of prosecutorial power. These drug laws have given so much power to prosecutors and taken power away from judges. It's very, very scary. And in many ways, the current war on terrorism and how it's being waged within this country has just borrowed the methodology from the war on drugs. And, you know, in the name of small government, I mean, the administration we have today is always saying that they're in favor of small government. Well, we have a very big government right now, and it has more power over ordinary people's lives than probably at any other time in our history. It's quite chilling. But again, in each one of these subjects, I start from a place of ignorance and learn as much as I can about it. And for me, it's very fascinating to do that. And then I try to sit down and figure it out and write it up and tell other people what I've learned, assuming that I didn't know this, and I think a lot of other people don't know it either.
So are solutions to the problems that you see occurring coming to you as well?
Well, you know, I wish I could just, you know, come up with the answer to every question and have this easy solution. And some of these questions are very, very complicated, and they're not going to be solved overnight. But what I feel my role is as a writer is just to even to get people to think about them, just to even raise these questions. I mean, so much of my work as an investigative reporter is digging out this information that I think is important, and these issues are important. You know, it depends on which part of this story you're talking about. I think that marijuana, a lot of the problems that stem from, you know, the marijuana industry could be solved very quickly. I think that if you were to decriminalize marijuana, you could do it quickly. It would have very few harmful effects. Other countries have done it. It would reduce the value of the black market. It would allow people who have AIDS and cancer to get access to the drug they need. I don't think more people would smoke pot. So the decriminalization of marijuana, that could be done very easily. Solving the issues of illegal immigration is more complex. It has to do also with the terrible state of the economy in Mexico, which is sending so many illegals. But I think we can make a start. And I think the way that you make a start is by focusing less on the legal status of an individual in the United States and less on their ethnic background, and just ensuring decent working conditions and decent wages for all Americans, for all workers. There are a lot of people in the United States who are already here who would perform a lot of these jobs if the wages were higher. So I think that, you know, we need stronger unions, especially for the most dangerous jobs and the most dirty and difficult jobs, and we need better wages. And I think we need to shift our emphasis from punishing poor people who are trying to come here to punishing the companies and employers who exploit them. But that's not going to happen overnight.
All right. Any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah. You know, I really don't feel like telling anyone how to live or what to do, but what I strongly believe in is that you should open your eyes and be aware of what's happening. And different people are going to come to different conclusions. But I think that the mainstream media has closed its eyes to a lot of what's happening in this country, and people therefore need to seek out the information on their own and open their eyes.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you.
I've been talking with author Eric Schlosser, best known for his book Fast Food Nation, and soon to be better known for his latest book Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market.